According to a news report in 2000, so a few years ago, a pig flew first class on a six-hour U.S. Airways flight from Philadelphia to Seattle. That's why I said a pig. Okay. Two passengers convinced the airline that the pig needed to fly with them as a therapeutic companion pet, like a seeing eye dog. So the pig was permitted to sit with them in the first class cabin of the plane. Passengers described the 300-pound pig as enormous, brown, angry, and honking. He was seated in three seats near the front of the plane, but the attendants reportedly had difficulty strapping him in. The pig became restless after takeoff and sauntered throughout the cabin. One passenger said he kept rubbing his nose on people's legs, trying to get them to give him food and stroke him. These are first-class passengers, right? Upon landing, things got worse. The article reports the pig panicked, running up and down through economy class, squealing. Many passengers, also screaming, stood on their seats to get away from the pig. It took four attendants to escort the pig out of the airplane, and he escaped upon reaching the terminal. He was later recaptured, however. When asked to comment on the story, U.S. Airways spokesman David Kestelveeder said, "We can confirm that the pig traveled, and we can confirm that it will never happen again." At one time or another, each of us has done something that seemed like a good idea at the time, but we later said, "That will never happen again. I am never doing that again." Experience is a hard teacher, but a good one. We learn from experience, and that is especially true when it comes to our spiritual lives. Life's experiences teach us God's lessons. Genesis 29. In this chapter, God has enrolled Jacob in the school of hard knocks. How many of you have been enrolled in the school of hard knocks? How many of you have graduated from the school of hard knocks? That's the school where dreams go to face reality, and sometimes those dreams turn into nightmares. We get knocked down. We get disappointed, but we learn to work through it all. Jacob met God in a dream in chapter 28, and God promised he would be with him always through everything, and he would bless him. But he's about to go through a lot of tough times in his life. Through that disappointment, through those struggles that we all face in the school of hard knocks, we learn to work through it all. We learn to follow God. We learn to trust God. Jacob had much to learn, and he will spend the next 20 years in the school of hard knocks, armed only with God's promise that God would be with him, that God would take care of him, that God would be near him, and God would lead him, and God would bless him. And Jacob will grow up in those years into a man, into the man that God wants him to become. And he will learn to follow God. And he will learn many lessons, and we can learn lessons as well from his story. The first lesson that he learns, however, is a pleasant one. God surprises us with love as we follow his lead. Genesis chapter 29, verse 1. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east, which is a reference, sons of the east, the land is always referring to Mesopotamia in the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone in the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well. And here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep." He said, "Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. So Jacob has covered about 500 miles in his month-long journey to Haran. And he arrives at a well outside of the town where three flocks of sheep were waiting to be watered by the shepherds. Now, water was a very precious commodity in the ancient world, and water rights were regulated. We've already seen in the study of Genesis a number of times where wells and agreements about watering rights were very important. A large stone over the top of the well, and wells weren't built up. They were down low near the ground, and a stone would be rolled over that well. A large stone served a double purpose. It kept the contamination out, the debris and the dust and all of that, because they didn't want to contaminate the water. And secondly, the stone served as a social control mechanism. It prevented herdsmen from taking more water than they should take. They couldn't just go up to the well and draw it dry. Typically, the stone would be large enough that it would take a couple of men to move it, but the opening of the well would be governed by a contract, an agreement. These were business people, and they set up contracts or agreements to govern the use of the well. Jacob arrives in the middle of the day. This was very odd to see flocks of sheep gathered at the well, because sheep were watered in the morning or they were watered in the evening. They were not watered in the middle of the day. They would be out on the range. And so he says, "What's going on here? Why are you not watering your sheep? These sheep should be out on the range. You're waiting to water your sheep." Now Jacob would know. He was a shepherd himself. These men were still waiting. There was likely, as near as we can tell, distrust among the businessmen of the area over the watering rights that would make them all agree to only open the well when all of the businessmen were, all of the flocks were gathered, so that everyone could tell who was taking how much water and they wouldn't be violating their water rights. And so they were waiting until all of the flocks were gathered and the business interests of the various businessmen were properly met before they opened the well and watered. And they were waiting for Rachel. She was Laban's business representative here to water the flocks. So they arrive. When they get to the well, she will be the last one to arrive. They can open the well, but she's late. and she hasn't arrived until now. I think she's late by divine appointment. She's late because God has set up an appointment for her to meet Jacob when he arrives. So Jacob talks with the other shepherds. He's been a shepherd. He knows the business well. He asks about Laban. Laban, by the way, is actually the grandson of Nahor. But we've already learned in Genesis that the word son is rather loosely used. While they're talking, Rachel arrives. And he sees Rachel. And women did tend sheep. She was a shepherdess. But they would likely only be sent to the well if the man didn't have sons, which he doesn't in this case. Obviously, the men told Jacob who she was, and he knows who she is as she arrives at the well. Now, we've talked a lot about Jacob's bad qualities. He's a conniving schemer, a con man, We've talked a lot about those bad qualities. In this chapter, we're going to see some very good qualities about Jacob. You know, the Bible's very honest, isn't it, about the fact that we are all flawed people, but we have good qualities, we have bad qualities. Jacob has good qualities and bad qualities. Here we'll see some of his good qualities. He's industrious, he's hardworking, he takes initiative, he's not afraid to act quickly. And so he sees Rachel arrive, he walks up to the well, he rolls the stone off the well, and what does he do? He takes and waters Rachel's flocks himself. He's hardworking, he takes initiative, it shows his strength. It also shows he wants Rachel's attention. He's like most guys who do something to get the attention of a pretty young lady, and he's getting her attention. And then he goes to Rachel and he introduces himself. Two actions strike us as odd in our Western American world. Number one, he kisses Rachel. That seems odd. It's actually a fairly common act among families in that culture. Family members would greet one another with a kiss on each cheek, and that would be true for both males and females. They wouldn't greet each other with a hug or a shake. They'd greet each other in the family with a kiss on each cheek. He is saying by this greeting, I'm part of the family. You're part of my family. It's a family greeting. It's not a romantic kiss. Second, Jacob lifted up his voice and he wept. In many cultures, even cultures today, men are much more emotionally demonstrative than we are in America, certainly than we are in New England. That's not the New England way for men to be emotionally demonstrative. But in many cultures they are, and in his culture certainly. It's been a long, hard journey for him. He's gone a long way, and God has led him to his family, and he's rejoicing in that. And I believe Jacob knows that God has led him to his bride at that moment. You know that he was sent to find a wife from Laban's daughters, and he sees her, and he loves her. I believe it is love at first sight. That happens. God arranged this meeting at the well that day. Laban could have sent her older sister, Leah, or he could have sent a servant. He did not. It was Rachel that Jacob met and fell in love with that day. A month later, just a month, that's why I say I believe it was love at first sight, just a month later, as we'll see as we go through the chapter, Jacob is asking for Rachel's hand in marriage from her father. So he didn't waste any time in going for it. And you know the story. Jacob will work 14 years for Rachel to be his wife. And it was a labor of love. The text later says that it passed like a few days because he was so in love with her. Jacob loved Rachel. And this is really, truly one of the great love stories of the Bible, Jacob and Rachel. Unlike Jacob's parents, Isaac and Rebekah, who didn't trust one another, and we studied how that trust tore apart the distrust tore apart the family, Jacob and Rachel loved and trusted each other throughout a very difficult life. Rachel will die later in childbirth. We'll come to that in chapter 35. She will die very near the place we call Bethlehem. And many years later, after long, long after her death, Jacob, Israel, he's renamed Israel, is in Egypt, and he is dying. And he gathers Joseph to give the last will and testament. Now, you know from our study of Genesis that that the blessing that the father gave was actually a formal legal agreement. It was like our last will and testament. So he gathers Joseph to give his last will and testament on his deathbed, his blessing. And in the midst of giving that legal last will and testament, he talks about one person in the middle of it, Rachel. He interrupts the last will and testament to talk about Rachel, who had died many years earlier. And this is what he says in the middle of it. "Now, as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem." Rachel never got to see Jacob's homeland. He never got to share his homeland with her. And she never got to meet his father Isaac, or his mother Rebekah, who had passed away by that time. But they loved each other deeply, and Jacob still grieved her death on his deathbed many, many years later. He talks about her. He doesn't talk about Leah. He doesn't talk about anybody else. He interrupts to talk about her in that last will and testament. It's a beautiful love story. It truly is. But it began as Jacob followed God's lead in life. Jacob never would have met Rachel if he hadn't trusted God enough to travel 500 miles to Haran. It wasn't where he wanted to be. It wasn't his plan. He had been scheming and planning a whole different plan. Jacob never would have met Rachel if he hadn't sinned. And because of his sin, his parents wanted, and his failure, his mother needed to get him out of there because Esau was trying to kill him, as we studied. So he never would have met Rachel if he hadn't failed or sinned and been sent off to Haran. God has a way of weaving our lives, even our failures, even our sins, even all of our choices that we make. He has a way of weaving those things into His plan. It may not be our plan. We often have our plans, but God has a way of weaving His will out in our lives and weaving all of those things together so that we follow His plan. And when we follow God, He surprises us. And sometimes He surprises us with love, like Jacob. Second principle, God teaches us patience through the discipline of hard work. Verse 13. "So when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Then he related to Laban all these things. Laban said to him, 'Surely you are my bone and my flesh,' and he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, 'Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?' Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, 'I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel.' Laban said, 'It is better that I give her to you than to give her to another man. Stay with me.' So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her." One writer has said, "Life is the art of drawing without an eraser." We don't get do-overs in life. We can certainly see that in the life of Jacob. He's been drawing without an eraser, and his drawing has led him to Rachel and to Laban. And God has some lessons to teach him, and he's going to learn those lessons through some hard work and through some injustice that is done to him. Because Laban is even more of a swindler than Jacob. He's more of a conniver, a con man, than Jacob. So in Laban, Jacob has met his match. And God will use Laban to teach Jacob patience. God will use Laban to knock his scheming ways out of him. For God needed to change Jacob. So we're introduced to the two sisters who will play a big role in the future of God's nation, Israel. Rachel is described as beautiful of form and face. Jacob loves her. Leah, the older sister, is described as having eyes that were weak. Now, that doesn't mean that she lacked 20/20 vision. That's not what the text is talking about. It probably is referring to the fact that her eyes were pale and lacked a luster or bright gleam to them. They were not pretty or beautiful eyes. It was considered a major flaw, a major beauty flaw in the ancient Near East for a woman to lack eyes that had this sparkling luster to them that were beautiful. Men liked women with bright, lively, glowing eyes. And so women, even in ancient times, we know this from archaeology, women decorated their eyes. They used eye makeup from ancient times because the eyes were the thing that men first were attracted to in the ancient world. It may also mean that her eyes were blue because it was considered a bad attribute for a woman to have blue eyes. Sorry, all you blue-eyed ladies. The men liked eyes to be brown, bright, and lustery. It's not a word, but that idea. And Rachel was beautiful, and she had those kind of eyes that were gorgeous and sparkled and attracted attention. Leah was not. And Jacob loved Rachel. Between 1925 and 1933, a team of American archaeologists excavated a site called Nuzi. It was an administrative site of the Hurrian Empire, located near Kirkuk in northern Iraq. They discovered what came to be called the Nuzi Tablets. Very important for understanding Genesis. We've already referred to them a couple of times, but important here in this passage because they tell us how things were done. These are clay tablets that were discovered dating back to about 1400 BC, so not long, a number of years, a few hundred years after the time of Jacob, but still back in his era. They tell us a lot about the legal culture. Laban does not have any sons, so he has no heirs. And the Nuzi tablets tell us what a man would do in that situation. So we understand here that Laban is not just asking how much Jacob wants to get paid. Do you want minimum wage? Do you want more? That sort of thing. He is proposing what the Nuzi tablets would call the adoption of a son to become your legal heir. He is proposing that he adopt Jacob as his legal heir. He has no sons. It was also common, we know from the Nuzi tablets, for an adopted son to marry the daughter of the father. In fact, we know from the Nuzi tablets that a sister wife had a much higher social status than just a regular wife. And we've probably explains why both Abraham and Isaac referred to their wives as sisters as well. Isaac, Abraham, in Abraham's case, of course, she was literally his sister. In Isaac's case, he probably formally, legally made her his sister because a sister wife had a higher social status than a regular wife. So, Jacob is proposing, or Laban is proposing, an adoption of Jacob, and Jacob is saying, all right, I will be adopted, but you give me Rachel as my wife, my sister wife. That will be the wages I will want in the form of this marriage. So Jacob loved Rachel. He asked to marry her as his wages, and they agreed that Jacob would work 7 years for Rachel. And we learn a great deal about Jacob here. He is persistent. He has a great deal of drive to accomplish his goal. 7 years he's going to work for Rachel. Now, that's an expensive dowry. Typical dowry in the ancient world was about 30 or 40 shekels, and the average annual wage was about 10 shekels. So Jacob is really paying 70 shekels in his dowry in order to have Rachel as his wife. See, Laban is no fool. He is taking advantage of Jacob. But guess what? Jacob doesn't mind. He loves Rachel. He'll work 7 years for Rachel. Look at verse 20 again. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. What a beautiful verse. What a beautiful statement of love. Jacob loved Rachel. The 7 years seemed to him nothing because of his love for her. Jacob's marriage had been planned by God. He was willing to wait and work for his true love. Those are wonderful qualities to Jacob. Patience is a virtue in marriage, and we learn patience through hard work. And Jacob is a wonderful example of true love here and his willingness to work hard and wait. I love the quote by Donald Gray Barnhouse, a longtime pastor many years ago. He wrote, "True marriages are made in heaven, and the reason the world says that many of them are waylaid before reaching earth is that too few people are willing to wait 7 years and know those years to be but a few days because of the depth and power of true love." Too few people are willing to wait for true love. But it takes that kind of waiting and that kind of working for true love to happen. And Jacob may be an example of many things, of many bad things, but he is an example of a good love in marriage. He is a great example of true love. True love waits and works and is patient and is persistent. And that is still true today, folks. Still true today. Jacob, like most of us, is a very complex figure. We've already seen his flaws as a schemer, conniver, but he has good qualities here. He is hardworking, he is faithful, he loves with a committed love. You know, we are imperfect people, every single one of us. We have flaws. God's grace and beauty are actually seen in our imperfections. God's grace and beauty is most beautifully seen in Jacob's flaws, in who he is and who he becomes, and how God redeems him. According to Japanese legend, a young man named Rikyu sought to learn the elaborate set of customs known as the Way of Tea. He went to tea master Takanoju, who tested the younger man by asking him to tend the garden, clean up the garden. Rikyu cleaned up debris and raked the ground until it was absolutely perfect. This garden was perfect, and the garden was immaculate. And then, before presenting his work to the master, he shook a cherry tree and dropped a bunch of flowers on the ground before he presented the garden to the master. And to this day, the Japanese revere Rikyu as one who understood wabi-sabi. Wabi-sabi is the art of finding beauty in imperfection, in flaws, and revering authenticity above all else. When a white pottery bowl would break, most people, particularly in the Greco-Roman world, would use a white lacquer and they'd hide the flaws and they'd make it all beautiful and try to pretend that there was no break in that pottery bowl. If you were Japanese, in the Japanese culture, unlike the Greeks, wabi-sabi would tell you to highlight the flaws. And so they would sprinkle it with gold leaf and other things, and they would bring out the crack as they fixed the pottery, because beauty was seen in the imperfections and the brokenness. Well, folks, the gospel is wabi-sabi. The gospel is all about how God looks at us in our flaws, in our imperfections, and he mends us and he makes us, but he doesn't hide the flaws. The flaws themselves, the imperfections themselves, become the testimony to God's glory. And that's why a redeemed person, you and me, we are imperfect people. And our story is about our imperfections and how God changes those imperfections into His beauty and His glory. And He doesn't hide those things. Broken people in a fractured world that God changes and redeems by His grace. That's the story of Jacob. It's my story. It's your story too. Third principle this morning. God humbles our pride through poetic justice. Verse 21. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her." Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now in the evening he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me?" But Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years." Jacob did so and completed her week, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. Someone has said that experience is the hardest kind of teacher. It gives you the test first and the lesson afterward. Well, Jacob would learn the hard way that cheating and lying your way through life is not God's way. It doesn't pay in the end. Eventually, you meet a better cheater. And Laban is a better cheater than Jacob. It's what we call poetic justice. God uses poetic justice to teach us the errors of our ways in life. He uses that correction that exactly matches the flaws or the errors in our lives. So we learn the lesson the hard way. So a wedding feast is planned. Typical wedding feast lasted 7 days or so. At the end of that period of time, the bride and groom would consummate the marriage. Jacob, of course, thought he was marrying Rachel, but Laban substituted Leah instead. How could this happen? Well, of course, you have to understand the cultural setting. There are probably a number of reasons. During that wedding feast, the bride would be hidden most of the time. If she was at all visible, she would be totally veiled. And even coming to that evening, she would be totally veiled. Maybe Rachel was the veiled participant for part of that, and then in the end, forcibly changed. We can only imagine Rachel's grief as she comes to realize her sister has taken her place. Means that Leah, by the way, was a willing participant of this deception. Leah may well have been in love with Jacob. I believe that she was, because of the rest of the story anyway, that she was in love with Jacob. The second reason I guess it could happen is, quite frankly, Jacob was probably drunk by this time. And he would not have known the difference because of his drinking. At any rate, he did not see the deception until the next morning. So deception comes back to bite Jacob real hard. God's lessons could hardly have been clearer to Jacob. Look at those lessons for a minute. Let's think about what God is doing in his life in allowing this, how he's being deceived, and how God is teaching him, testing him and teaching him through this hard lesson. Look at the lessons. Well, Jacob stole the right of the firstborn through deception. Leah retained the right of the firstborn through deception. Jacob deceived his father Isaac. Laban, his adopted father, deceived Jacob. Jacob tricked his brother. Leah tricked her sister. Jacob wore Esau's clothes to trick his father. Leah wore Rachel's bridal clothes to trick Jacob. Talk about poetic justice. This is like a mirror image. Jacob could hardly have missed the test and the lessons that God was teaching him through this horrible experience. It's a classic case of poetic justice. And God teaches us in the very same way. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 15 says, "Good understanding produces favor, but the way of the treacherous is hard." The choices we make in life bear fruit eventually. Is God fair? Always, always just. And often that justice is played out in the consequences we experience in our lives. If we treat others with integrity, with honesty, we enjoy favor, Proverbs tells us. But if we treat others with treachery and deceit and lies, we will reap hard things in return. The very joys we pursue will be turned to pain. We lose out on the good things in life. New Testament says we reap what we sow. That is a biblical principle. So poetic justice is God's way of humbling us as he humbled Jacob. Jacob, of course, confronts Laban. He's given the lame excuse that the older must be married before the younger. In reality, what's Laban doing? Laban just wanted to get out of the cost of caring for Leah. She obviously was not going to be married off, and he wanted her out. He pawned her off on Jacob. So Laban proposes another deal. How many deals do you go through with this guy? Work another 7 years for Rachel. Actually, he will get Rachel after 1 week. But he has to work the 7 years to pay for her. So after the honeymoon, the 1 week honeymoon, then he would be given Rachel. But he would work 7 years to pay off that debt. That's the test put before Jacob. What will you do? Jacob agrees. A week later, he has Rachel as his wife. Now, God clearly later outlaws this kind of marriage. In Leviticus, God says you can't marry two sisters. You can't do that. So we know that's not God's intention for marriage. Let's not look at this as God's intention for marriage. But it is something that God uses in his life. And Jacob has a choice. Like we all do when we're faced with God's tests. Jacob has a choice. The choice he makes will tell us if he has learned God's lessons. The scheming Jacob, what would he do? The scheming, conniving Jacob would have been working the angles and figuring out another way to outwit Laban and get what he wanted. Maybe he'd take off. Maybe he wouldn't fulfill his obligation or his debt because he'd been cheated. After all, if I'm unjustly treated on the job, why can't I just take my marbles and go? Let's just get out of here. But Jacob does not do that. He is learning. He is learning to keep his word. He is learning to be a man of integrity, to deal honestly with others. And he chooses to fulfill his full 7-year obligation to Laban as payment, just as he agreed to do, even though he knows Laban has totally deceived and treated him unjustly and unfairly. That's a hard lesson, but God is cleansing him through the school of hard knocks. How does God change you and me? He changes us through the school of hard knocks, and he gives us the test, and then we find out, am I going to live right anyway, even though I've been wronged? Jacob lives right anyway, even though he's been wronged, and he fulfills his obligations for the next 7 years. God changes us, he cleanses us, he remakes us through those processes. Pastor Tim Keller, in his book Walking with God Through Suffering, tells about how British shepherds often take sheep one by one, and they throw them into this dipping trough. It's a huge vat filled with antiseptic liquid. And the shepherd must completely submerge each animal, holding ears, eyes, nose, everything under the antiseptic. And now you can imagine, if you're one of those sheep, this is a horribly fearful experience, terrifying, frightening experience. If any of the sheep try to climb out, the sheepdogs are trained to bite them, nip at them, get them back into the trough to be pushed under once again. It's a terrifying experience for a sheep. But it's absolutely necessary to go through periodically, because if not, then the sheep become victims of parasites and disease. It's for their good. How often does God do that in your life? How often does He put you in the trough of antiseptic and submerge you, kicking and screaming, into something you don't want to do or be, in order to cleanse you, in order to make you whole? God does that, doesn't He? It's called the school of hard knocks. It's called life experience. And God changes us and remakes us through that process. He's shaping us through those life experiences into the men and the women of God that He wants us to be. He's remaking us. We have to learn to wait on God for the results in our lives. And I don't know about you, but I hate waiting. I hate waiting on God. But that's how He moves, and that's how He works. Author Richard Hendricks wrote, "Second only to suffering, waiting may be the greatest teacher and trainer in godliness, maturity, and genuine spirituality most of us ever encounter." Anybody here like to wait? No. But that's how God works in our lives. Jim Collins is a popular writer about leadership in the corporate world. He wrote a book that was a bestseller called Good to Great. It's a study of how successful companies made the transition from being good to being better and then to being great companies. And he uses an analogy in that book that I think we can apply to our spiritual lives. He uses the analogy of an egg. And he says the good to great companies, everyone that he studied, were like an egg. It takes a long time before the chick hatches from that egg. And while the chick is developing inside that egg, you look at the egg, you can't tell. It doesn't look like anything's happening inside that egg because you can't see what is going on. And eventually, the great company hatches. Eventually, the chick emerges from that egg, and you realize there's been a long process that led to that point. And he applies that to the corporate world. But applying it to our spiritual lives is good. God is growing you through a lengthy process. And like an egg, it may not be evident to everybody else who's watching you. They may not be able to see what is going on, but God is growing you inside that eggshell. And one day you're going to hatch. One day you're going to pop out and somebody's going to say, "Whoa, where did you come from?" It's because God has been working in you and you have been changing and growing out of sight inside. That's how God works. You're developing. And we get impatient, but you don't want to break that egg. We want to hatch soon. We want the process to come to an end. I'm sure Jacob did. 14 years, a long time. But God says, you're inside the egg right now. Give it time, and the day will come. Can't speed up that process. So just as Jacob learned through many years of hard knocks, we often learn through life experience what God wants to teach us. How's God teaching you this morning? You know, we're stubborn. We want it our way, but God is faithful. He's at work. Never give up on God at work, in your family, in your lives, in your situations. God's at work. Trust Him. He will teach you His ways. He will. Father, thank You that You are faithful. in all of our mess-ups, in all of our problems, in all of our failures. We know that you are still at work in our lives, and you are redeeming us in our imperfections, and you are making us whole, even with our imperfections. And you are using us, and we praise you and trust you this morning and ask you to teach us your ways this week. In Jesus' name, amen.